So take a look at the first part, the introduction of the theme Planet Debt. Let's move to 12 things you need to know about global debt, because I think it's very, it's very important to me to bring this down to sort of the 411, because I know you're all busy people and have many things to do. And ultimately, I want you to understand what's going on in global debt as a way of really having a good map that can help you navigate. So let's get down to the 12 things you need to know. So turn to the section called 12 things you need to know about global debt. Let's start. Number one, global debt's nearly doubled since 2007 and 2014. This was not what I expected coming out of the financial coup. I thought, okay, we'll manage the debt. It won't keep exploding. What's interesting about this continued explosion of global debt is that coming into the bailout period, the developed world was highly leveraged, but the developing world was not. What has happened during this period is the developing world has taken on a significant amount of debt, China being one of them. There was one study, one of the McKinsey studies I posted on the website, estimated that 35% of global growth since 2007 came from China's leveraging up. And a lot of that was done with, in fact, with dollar-denominated debt. We now have over 39 countries with a total debt-to-GDP ratio above 100%. 90% is sort of supposed to be the place that you stagnate. And when you look at those numbers, it's very important to understand that for the countries that are issuing in debt in a currency that they can just print, it's a very different story than the ones who are not. Also, we have some countries that are running big, that are big financial centers like Singapore or the Netherlands that look like they have more debt than when you sort of look at what they facilitated. It's really a different picture. And finally, we have some countries that have enormous sovereign wealth funds. And so if you look at their debt on a net basis, they're much stronger than they look. But nevertheless, it's a picture of tremendous debt that keeps on growing. And of course, the question that we all keep asking is, what's the end game? And I think it's very important to understand that a lot of what you see here is not so much a financial system, it's a governance system. Debt is the way that we're affecting central control. And that brings us to the sort of the second question, which is, well, who owns the debt? And this is where the debt picture gets very frustrating. Point number two is the accessible statistics on debt are very insufficient to see our situation clearly. First of all, the available information on global debt is spotty. The statistics on who issues, that is, who borrows, is pretty good, particularly for global sovereign debt. Although I would point out, in the case of U.S. sovereign debt, I absolutely believe that the numbers are not reliable, and I have a lot of anecdotal experience and stories to say that they aren't, including that the federal government has refused to produce audited financial statements for decades, as is required by law. So they have violated the law by not producing financial statements. And if somebody refuses to comply with the law about their financial statements, there's likely to be serious problems with them. But there is good statistics on government borrowers, at least their overt borrowing, and less statistics on financial institutions, small business households, where there is highly insufficient data is on who really owns the debt. And this is tricky because a lot of times if you look at who owns it, they in fact can be sort of what's called cut out or front organizations, and the guy who really controls it is behind the scenes. So putting together a picture of who owns the debt can get very murky. Clearly where debt is owned by pension funds, mutual funds, foreign governments, there's a lot of good statistics there. But the reality is that a clear, coherent picture of who controls the debt is as hidden behind the one-way mirror as the one-way mirror of the digital data beast. And I suspect they converge, and that's for a reason. But the picture has yet to be illuminated. Number three, global debt is an essential component of the central banking warfare model. So as I said, put aside the healthy lenders, a lot of what we're watching with the growth of global debt is not an alignment where you're trying to help parties build more equity, but it's a control system and a governance system. And that control system very much depends on the military, which is why there is a relationship between the global military expenditures spent by the people with fiat currencies in the central banking warfare model and the debt that gets issued. So it's a circular picture. You issue debt to finance the military that makes it possible to force people or get people to take your currency and your debt denominated in your fiat currency, and around you go. Number four, understanding the economy requires financial statements which integrate the covert cash flows. One of the reasons I get so frustrated when people say, oh, we're bankrupt. Well, if you issue debt and then spend money on secret projects, and the secret projects aren't on the balance sheet, and the, you know, whether it's the underground facilities or the spaceships or the, you know, the black budget weaponry. So if all the assets are not on the balance sheet, but the debt is, then of course you're going to look bankrupt. But we need to have a conceptual framework in our minds for a balance sheet that incorporates the debt that they issue off balance sheet and the assets that disappear and the money that disappears. So, again, it's frustrating because we don't have, we don't have financial statements for the covert side, but we're going to have to imagine them into the balance sheet and into the income statements because they're very, very real. And it's one of the reasons why, people looking at the official statements were saying, oh, the economy is going to collapse. And I'm trying to intuit the covert flows and saying, no, it's going to slow burn. And that's one of the reasons why. Number five, invasive digital systems have fundamentally altered the nature and economics of debt. As I said, digital systems have converted the financial system to something that can be used to entrap and harvest at an individual level. It's not just hits on countries, it's hits on people. And let me give you an example, because it's one I saw when I moved to the South. It's one I saw implemented in a very, I live in a county of very modest means, and I watched it played on people who had very little money and saw the dramatic impact that it had on their lives. Okay, so let's take a nice middle-class family, and the father has a nice job in a manufacturing company, decides to, he's doing very well, so he decides to buy a new home. He originates, he and his wife originate a mortgage for their family of four. They from a local bank, from a local financial institution. They the bank sells the mortgage to Fannie Mae after collecting the origination fee. Again, the institution is not liable on the mortgage once it's been securitized. The father works at a local manufacturer, and the financial institution happens to know that they're moving to Mexico, but the father doesn't. They don't tell the father that he's about to lose his job, which is, of course, a material omission. 24 hours after he loses his job, miraculously, his credit card company just happens to raise the interest rates to 30%, not surprisingly. One of his kids gets sick a couple weeks later. The family's lost its medical coverage, so the father has to use the credit card to pay for the expenses. So now he's paying 30% interest rate on the medical expenses, and as you can imagine, falls behind on his mortgage payment. At that point, the family's only income is unemployment compensation and food stamps, which is clearly insufficient to cover the family's overhead despite very significant reductions in their spending. Mysteriously, a local marijuana dealer just happens to know that now's a propitious time to make a visit. Just think of it as a marketing call. The father, being under extreme stress, begins to smoke again in order to handle the stress. One night while he's getting high, an associate of the drug dealer steals his car, and the insurance covers the cost, but the insurance premiums go up, and of course he can't His credit score has essentially been destroyed, so he doesn't qualify for an auto loan, which means he has to buy a used car, which is financed at a predatory rate. Again, more origination fees and all sorts of fees involved. The family is now desperate, and they sell their home to pay to liquidate the remaining equity to cover living expenses and the high interest rates they're paying on the auto loan and on the their higher mortgage premiums, and then, of course, the 30% interest on the medical expenses. The financial institution originates another loan and, again, sells it to Fannie Mae. The auto loan and the Fannie Mae pools are securitized and sold to a fund that's held in the father's IRA, that is, before he liquidates it to help pay for his mortgage and auto loan. When Fannie Mae goes bust in 2008, the taxpayers, including this family, are called upon to finance the bailout. Interestingly enough, when a banker at the financial institution realizes that client data is being compromised and they're engaging in predatory practices, she tries to blow the whistle and, in fact, is murdered on one morning when she's out jogging and is found on the jogging path dead. So in a relatively short period, the family goes from being a successful middle-class family with savings to a family that's been profitably harvested by the financial system. And what the father and the family and those around him cannot fathom is that the financial institution, the credit card company, the marijuana dealer, the car thief, the car dealer, and the insurance company were all drawing from essentially one relational database operation designed to profitably harvest people and locations. The one person who could fathom it is the banker who tried to be a whistleblower and ended up dead. And that is what is happening, and it's happening via our televisions, our computers, our smartphones, our smart meters. American households are providing access to personal and intimate financial data, and that is going to syndicates of intelligence agencies and large corporations who are using that data to do a variety of things, but one is to harvest people in very predatory ways. And so, as I said, the one-way mirror allows the economic hitman to be done on an economic basis against poor people. And so we've engineered and created a structure where creditors can make money engineering failure. And as I said, when creditors work hard to help people succeed, it's a very different model than when it's an entrapment machine and they profit from failure. Okay, number six. Consolidating the global economy necessitated that the war on terror target financial institutions in Islam. A very important thrust of the war on terror has been to get the Islamic world to make its financial flows transparent to the Western financial institutions and intelligence agency. It's part of the whole effort to build a global digital infrastructure that will allow the U.S. to enforce against global financial institutions on the pretext that they're involved with American deposits or investments one way or the other. But also it's important to understand that the Islamic principles reject interest and certainly usurious levels of interest. And if you look at the financial model, the debt model that was being used really is an entrapment model. It was not going to fly in Islam. And so a great effort has been made on the pretext of the war of terror to get Islam to be brought into the West's central banking warfare model. And that is a very important part of what has happened. The seventh thing you need to know is that the digital systems combined with revisions of law related to usury, bankruptcy, student loans, as well as the foreign financial institutions, that has all made it possible to assert the kind of control that you need is in terms of legal and financial mechanisms to maintain what's called enormous divergence in the cost of capital between insiders and outsiders or between preferred players and the average person. This is very much at the heart of the slow burn, and I talk about it a lot. But, for example, in the 1990s, while someone like our father, who I just described an example, is paying 30% on his interest rates on his credit card, we had hedge funds borrowing on the yen carry trade for 0%. So for preferred players who were playing along with the inside game could get capital for 0%, whereas certain people in America are paying 30%. That's an enormous divergence, and it went on for many, many years. Certainly Senator Elizabeth Warren has talked about how the big banks can borrow at the Fed window for essentially 0%, whereas students on federal education loans are paying a tremendous amount. And that divergence has been going on for many, many years. I know in the end of the last housing bubble in 89, 90, 91, you watched tremendous federal credit arbitrage where banks were borrowing, essentially for zero and turning around and putting it into the long treasury market for, at that point, it was a 500, 600 basis point spread, making enormous profits. And that's how they rebuilt their equity. Some of that happened. The spread was not as extreme. But that's part of what happened during the bailouts, was the access to capital was made possible at very low cost, while many people in America were paying a much higher cost. And of course, as taxpayers, they were having to backstop and fund the bailouts in the first place. These kinds of divergences in cost of capital basically rig society so that some win and some lose, not because they're efficient in the marketplace, but because they have a rigged deal. And this is part of what's been destroying the health of the economy, because ultimately rigged players make things less productive and they make things stupid. The eighth thing you need to know is that the national security state's integration of the invasive digital systems has expanded the use of debt as a weapon of economic warfare and financial coup d'etat. And if you look at the explosion of global debt, it doesn't seem to be letting up whatsoever. The important thing to understand is when you look at debt with these systems, you need to see it as part of a package. So economic warfare, if you lend to someone and then you proceed to act against them with cyber warfare and financial sanctions. Perfect example was the farmers in the 80s. If you study the militia movement, you discover what happened in the late 70s. An effort was made to dramatically increase the lending to farmers. Farmers were encouraged to take out, these American farmers were encouraged to take out enormous loans, and after they did, suddenly the farm subsidies were cut, and the Fed dramatically increased interest rates, and so the cost of their debt skyrocketed. At the same time, the subsidies they depended on to pay the debt were cut, and so it was a move of economic warfare. Many farmers went bust. The FBI and the IRS moved against them as well, and so many of them were forced to or lost their land, and large players consolidated and picked up a huge amount of land, and as they were moved off the land, they realized that they had been targeted by economic warfare, hence they organized into the militia groups. And a great deal was made by the press as to how sort of radical or horrible these people weren't. They weren't radical or horrible at all. If you see what had been done to them, that was pretty radical and pretty horrible. But what you're seeing is a very systemic use of these kinds of techniques of economic warfare, and debt is simply a piece of it, which is why when you participate as a business or an individual in borrowing or taking out debt, you really need to see the full portfolio of the people you're dealing with and how. Is it a straight up financial deal, or are you, by entering into a debt with that institution, making yourself out to be a target of economic warfare? The ninth thing you need to know is that the growth of debt, as I said before, as an entrapment system since World War II, has inspired significant and growing blowback. And I think there is a real plan B underway. I think Mr. Global is certainly permitting that plan B, and now the Americans are facing a much more informed global audience and growing economic competition. Okay, the 10th thing you need to know, global debt, who controls? We don't know who controls the debt. And one of the hardest things I have in predicting the American position is, you know, to what extent do the Americans control a lot of that debt quietly behind the scenes or not? Who really controls that debt? Another question, a little more certainly far out, is it an open or closed system? In other words, do members of the human race and their institutions own and control all that debt? So are we just borrowing money from each other? Are other civilizations involved? I have to ask that question because I don't know. But the fact that it's uncertain means that we don't know if it's an open or closed system. And who really controls? I think, as I said before, if you could follow those dollars and contracts back, ultimately we could see who Mr. Global really was and what the current governance arrangements really are. But who owns and controls that debt has very, very powerful implications for the evolution of civilization. You know, and if the genie came out of the bottle, that's a question, that's certainly a question that I would want answered. The 11th thing you need to know is I call this Houston, we have a problem. The problem with the debt system and the exploding debt system is the puppet master who controls the strings, is clearly trying to assert much tighter and greater control over society. And the part of this that scares me to death is when you look at what they're up to with healthcare and education in this country. I think you're talking about wiping out the last vestiges of local economies and doing it in a way that give corporations and intelligence agencies direct access to children in a way which I can only describe as terrifying. It's almost as though somebody said, look, let's think of kids as simply oil and gas deposits to be harvested. We're going to organize things to get to simply exploit them as an economic resource. It's pretty terrifying. So I think one of the things we need to think about is how can we reverse engineer the entrapment, because this is going no place good. The last thing you need to know about global debt is we need to be thinking about the end game, because we don't know what the end game is, but it's going to be part of an ongoing conversation on the Solari report. Because we're going to have to see how things unfold. But I think it's important to you and me how it unfolds. And so, again, ongoing conversation. Let me describe a couple of my expectations of the general direction where planet debt is taking us. One is, the goal is to re-engineer global governance, and this is all part of an expanding financial coup d'etat. The financial coup d'etat did not end with the bailouts. It's kept on going. So I expect to see further centralization of currencies and the implementation of digital currencies. One subscriber put in a question for Ask Catherine asking about the latest push by JP Morgan Chase to outlaw cash in its safe deposit box and discourage cash. It all fits in. This is how we're pushing for the implementation of digital currencies. And of course, digital currencies mean money that can be tracked 24/7 by systems and artificial intelligence, again, all part of the digital data beast. The second thing I expect is increased what I call piratization. Piratization is privatization that does not reflect market values. It reflects windfall subsidies and profits for private investors and corporations. I think high debt loads are going to be used to force countries and municipalities to privatize valuable assets. High debt loads are going to force many citizens to go along, or dependence on subsidies financed with debt. And I think this is going to continue to help grow the number of large corporations and their earnings and assets, and get more companies into the securitized space, where, again, centralized control is easier to effect. I think there's going to be continued pressure on retirement benefits and pension obligations in the developed world. And part of that's going to happen by simply making pension funds buy a lot of debt, which is then debased, and that effectively drains their yields. But there's going to be pressure to direct pension fund assets to serve centralized interests. One of the things that concerns me about the federal mandates to re-engineer education in this country is I think part of it is to engineer labor out of it, so you can use online systems and other systems to make it very economic for corporations to control and have direct access to children without teachers interfering. But then this one of the biggest pools of capital in this country are teacher pension funds, and I think the more you get the teachers in a corner, the easier it is to impact what happens with those pension funds. I think there's going to be increased global activity on large infrastructure projects. Certainly, if you have this kind of infinite debt capacity, there's no doubt one of the things that there's tremendous demand for infrastructure globally if you rebalance the global economy, and that's going to happen one way or another. I think another thing is there's going to be pressure to keep up military expenditures as the developed world tries or sort of chokes on their military expenditures levels and probably diminishes them. There's going to be pressure on the developing world to pick up the tab and increase military expenditures. And certainly if the Bretton Woods system continues to unravel, which it looks like it is, then you're going to have more countries around the world feeling the necessity of having those military expenditures to basically defend their position and get other people to take their currency. I think we're going to have continued high levels of global indebtedness for some time. You need a lot more cooperation to move from a world of this high indebtedness to something that makes a lot more sense. You see the Christine Lagarde at the IMF talking a lot about this and the danger of global stagnation as a result. And I think one of the reasons the BRICS are moving so strongly to come up with alternative systems that will allow a model that promotes the growth of equity is they understand at some point, as one subscriber always says, at some point we have to bake more pies. We can't just sit around stealing each other's pies. I expect continued growth in the size of global equity markets. It's to a certain extent, if you look at the explosion of debt as the bond market turns, which I think it will, the question is, where is all the cash going to go? Where's all the money going to go? And I think the reality is it's going to go into the equity markets. It's going to crash up the value of real assets. Now, that doesn't have to happen. There are scenarios where we go into a deflation and war and things very much go down in a sort of the Great Depression scenario. But I believe the crash up is much more likely, particularly if you look at all the plans to bring companies and assets into the securitized markets and to build out the infrastructure of the rebalancing of the global economy. So I think a crash up is more likely, but again, the alternative can happen, which is really very much a crash down. And I think there's going to be continued inquiry as to where all the missing assets and money are disappearing to. One of the reasons that everyone or many of us feel drained on planet Earth is we are being drained. It's almost as though we have, think of planet Earth as a giant mortgage REIT and there's a dividend disappearing to someone somewhere. And the reality is if producing that dividend is something that continually destroys equity, at some point we're really going to collapse, whether environmentally or economically. So I think there's going to be more and more inquiry as to, listen, where is all this missing money going? And why do we have to do it this way? Because unfortunately, the secrecy and the controls between top-down mandates, centralized control, and missing money, we're talking about a phenomenally unproductive economic system and one that, literally, if you could turn this around to a system that optimized building wealth, you could have hundreds of the financial wealth that we have now. There's no economic reason for poverty on this planet. But at the same time, we can't get to a system that lives in harmony with the ecology and allows us to optimize in markets with each other without having some manner of truth and clarity about the governance system and where we're really putting our governmentally induced assets. what is absolutely essential for you to know from looking at the Planet Dead situation is it's extremely important that when you personally or your business engages in any debt transaction, you need to understand what are the financial institutions who are aligned and make money from your success, and which are the ones that are not aligned and make money from your failure. And it's extremely important to, as much as possible, to only connect and allow institutions or people in your life that are aligned, and to avoid the others. It's one of the reasons that you'll hear Franklin Sanders often say that all government money comes with a sock in the jaw. And that's it. You're taking money from somebody with whom you're not aligned. But I appreciate sometimes you have to. So it's a very individual and unique situation. Okay, that's it for the 12 things you need to know. Again, please check out the web presentation. I think there's some wonderful graphs and charts and information for you. And our team has worked very hard to get them. And I hope you enjoy them.